Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Dr. James Goodnight to the broadcast. Jim is one of the creators of SAS software and is the chief executive officer of SAS Institute, the developer of analytics software that owns the largest market share for advanced analytics. Jim co-founded SAS Institute as a faculty member of North Carolina State University in 1976 and has been CEO ever since. Jim, along with fellow faculty member Anthony James Barr, were the project leaders for the early development of SAS, and when the software reached 100 customers in 1976, Jim and three colleagues founded the SAS Institute after leaving the university. As CEO, Jim has grown the company from a $138,000 revenue organization with 21 employees in the late 1970s to a over $3 billion revenue organization with nearly 14,000 employees as of 2013. In 2004, Jim was named a Great American Business Leader by Harvard and was also named one of America's 25 most fascinating entrepreneurs by Inc. magazine. He also frequently speaks and participates at the World Economic Forum, and Jim is also ranked number 58 on the Forbes 400 Richest Americans list with a net worth of $7.2 billion. Jim holds a master's degree and a PhD in statistics from North Carolina State University. I recently caught up with Jim in his office in Cary, North Carolina, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed SAS's unique culture, Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we covered Jim's perspectives on the importance of data and analytics to business, as well as a variety of other topics. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Well, Dr. Goodnight, thank you so much for taking a little time with me. I thought I'd begin with the beginning of SAS. You began it while you were an academic at North Carolina State. And I was curious, actually, when the whole concepts behind statistical analysis system came to fruition, were you an entrepreneur seeking an idea, or was it an idea that made you into an entrepreneur?
Well, I would say that when I was a sophomore, I took the only course in programming. Summer of my sophomore year, I had two jobs as programming. In the fall, I went to work for the Department of Statistics. And the statistics department had a group of statisticians that were referred to as experiment station. The experiment station helped design and analyze all the agricultural experiments that went on campus. NC State is a land-grant university. And there's one in every state, and the entire Southeast Association of Experiment Stations send one or two people each year to an annual meeting where they discuss computational methods and experiments that they've been doing. And NC State was sort of out in front of developing analytical software, and the entire Southeast Experiment Station people decided just to use what was coming out of NC State at the time. Back in about late 66, early 67, after the IBM 360 came out, everybody at all the universities were buying these IBM machines. They again looked to us to develop software for those machines. Tony Barr started some of the first parts of SAS, and then I joined him once it was stable enough to start writing additional procedures. And we announced SAS in 1969 to the experiment station users. The name of the group was USAS, University Statisticians of the Southern Experiment Station. And they all liked what they saw, and they started using it. And we went on developing SAS. I was putting myself through, finished up my master's and working on my PhD at the time. So I was working about 30 hours a week on the project. And back in 1972, I finished my PhD, and we lost all of our funding from the NIH. NIH, up until 72, was providing funds for almost every computing facility at all the different universities around the country. And Nixon decided he wanted to only spend money on universities that had hospital and cancer research and things like that. So you had to have a medical facility from then on for NIH to provide funding. So we went back to our university statisticians group and said, how about supporting us? They each chipped in $5,000 a year to support us. And they insisted, though, we start also licensing our software to other companies and other government agencies. So we started doing that so that we could become self-sufficient so they wouldn't have to pay. That went on until about 1976, at which time we had a user conference down in Florida. Our users actually put the conference together. We went down. There were 350 users there, and we were most impressed. They really liked some of the new stuff we were working on. So when we got finished with it and came back, I said, guess we ought to get out of the university. We are not able to grow anymore. There's clearly a lot of interest. We can support ourselves. We don't need to hang on here at the university. Of course, the university at the time was not supposed to be in business anyway, so I thought it was a good idea that we move off campus as well. So we moved across the street, and that's how the SAS was founded. But it had a long development history at the NC State University before we left. I think we left with about 300,000 lines of code. It's probably 10 million lines of code now. So we did start it at NC State, but it has continued to fall year after year.
In those early days, as you were building the company, who were some of the business leaders who were influential upon you?
I can't say that there were any. Of course, you know, I wasn't young. I was 32 when we started SAS. And we had been managing the SAS project, as we called it, at the university for probably 7 or 8 years, so we had been doing this all along. So it was nothing new to us, except that we weren't guaranteed a paycheck. We were able to line up enough business that we actually made it through. We started the 1st of July in 1976, and by the end of the year, we had actually made a little profit, as well as paying all of our salaries and everything.
One of the things that's often written about as a part of the power behind SAS is the culture that you've created, and the fact that it is perhaps unique. It's something I know that you and other leaders here think a great deal about and hold dearly. And I wonder if you could take a moment to describe the culture and the extent to which it has been intentionally driven versus those things that have grown out of it more organically.
Well, again, we were all coming from spending quite a few years working at the university when we founded SAS. So we were used to the idea of doing research, working long into the night sometimes to get stuff done. We were used to having health care paid for, so we had the university, we just continued on. And then as the company grew, it became clear that to attract and retain knowledge workers, because everything we do at SAS comes out of the heads of the people here. So they have got to be treated and respected, or you won't have them anymore. So we always try to have a lot of respect for people that work here, provide some very good benefits. I think the industry that we're in does tend to pamper the workers. So look at one of the most successful companies, Google. They rank above us in the best place to work list. We were number one again this year. We were number two. And I think NetApp, some of the other tech companies have also been up there. So I think tech companies realize the importance of the people that work there and need to find ways to keep them happy, but also keep them motivated, keep them innovating. And to a programming person, someone who writes programs, challenge of the job is the most important thing. I think money ranks second or third, but challenging work is what everyone ranks first. So that's what we try to do here. We try to keep it challenging.
Another interesting thing about the culture is that you have rejected opportunities to be acquired. You've also elected not to go public, whereas many of the technology companies that are peers of yours, in terms of size at least, have elected to do so. Can you talk a bit about why you've elected to stay private and the advantages of having done so?
I think probably 99% of the corporations in this country are private. There's 1% or so that are public companies. And a lot of those have gone for different reasons. A lot of them, especially in the IT industry, they got their funding from venture capitalists. And after 5 years, venture capitalists won't have an exit strategy, so they can get out and get their money out and move on to other investments. So that's why so many companies go public, because the money that's been invested in them, they're getting pressure from the backers to have that strategy to get out. We never needed that money to start with. We were all in our late 20s, early 30s, so we had built up enough to last. Again, we were profitable the first year, and we've been profitable now for 38 years. Every single year we've been profitable. And that's one of the goals, is to make sure we always stay profitable. Our biggest cost here is people. People represents about 75% of our total expenses. So if we can be careful in hiring and not hire too many people, then we might have a really good forecast or heavy, heavy workload in R&D. And people always want to hire more people. And you have to have the consistency of being able to hold the lid on when people want to hire people. We've been able to do that this past year very well. This year, I try to hold our headcount growth down to about 3.5%. And most of it has to do with the fact that we have so much of our revenue, about 70% of our revenue is recurring revenue from our renewal license model. So we have an extremely hard time growing at more than like 15% at this stage of our span. Because to grow 15% means we have to increase our new sales by about 50%. And 50% year over year of revenue growth in new sales is just, it's hard to achieve. But we do continue this year. We've set a double-digit revenue growth as a target. And we're trying to make sure that we find ways to accomplish them. We have the products. The products are there. So it's just a matter of execution in the field.
It seems that you, and certainly I think it's echoed in your sentiment there, that you can take a much longer-term approach as a private company than a public company might otherwise do. You're not a slave to quarterly earnings. You don't have to worry too much about the natural ebbs and flows that the business cycles will exert upon a company like this. May not mean as dramatic a response as your peers among public companies might take. Is that all fair?
That is very accurate. I mean, we certainly watch our P&L. We have, by the 10th of every month, we have a year-to-date P&L where we stand. We want to make sure that our expense growth is less than our revenue growth. Anytime that gets out of line, then we'll take some corrective action to slow down hiring. The fact is that if our profits don't grow and continue to grow every year, so what? But we have our comfort level of what our profits should be, and we try to maintain about a 15% profit level, and that is sufficient to fuel growth for us. So we don't have to be draconian and say, oh my gosh, we've got to go lay off 1,000 people, or 2,000, or 3,000, or whatever. There are a lot of companies in the tech field that their CEOs just don't have a problem laying people off. It's like, well, we have to do this to prove to our shareholders that our profits are improving. Actually, anybody can lay off a bunch of employees and have your profits increase. Again, well, as long as your payout packages aren't too expensive. I think it's as much as we still have to do and continue to develop. Things like layoffs just don't make any sense. I know it was at the end of 08. I think SAP had announced they were going to have, 3,000 layoffs. And their stock went up. And that makes me really mad. Because the head of the company announces that, hey, we have been really sort of stupid in the past and we hired too many people. Now we're going to let them go and then the company gets rewarded for it. It doesn't make sense. I can understand it from a financial standpoint, but it just doesn't make sense.
For obvious reasons, began the company in this area. This is where you were doing your academic work, as the affiliation with the university early on. I wonder if you could talk a bit about being located in the Research Triangle, the couple of examples you gave as other companies who rank among the best places to work or in Silicon Valley, where a lot of your competition is, a lot of your, again, peer organizations of comparable size in the tech world are located. What have been the advantages of being in Cary, North Carolina, as opposed to Palo Alto or another place in Silicon Valley, let's say?
Well, it's a beautiful wooded area here, lots of trees, and we're 2 hours from the beach and about 3 and a half hours from the mountains. So it's a great location. We're surrounded by great universities, well, at least one, NC State. Lesser degree, Carolina and Duke. We have more PhDs in this region than any other metropolitan area. I think Seattle, Washington, I've seen the number of college graduations. Raleigh comes in like second or third. But as number of PhDs, this area, I believe that's more than any other area. It's a haven for very, very intelligent people. And so it makes it easier to recruit. I mean, we still hire people from out of state when we're looking for certain jobs, but the quality of computer science graduates and technology graduates in our university is very high here. We always try to recruit locally here.
I also wonder, as head of company, how have your responsibilities evolved as the company has grown? What are you doing today that may be different from what you did years ago?
Well, the only real difference is I don't get to program much anymore. I'll work program once in a while, but by and large, I don't have any development things that I'm doing. I tend more to work with people who have ideas. I'll have ideas, and I'll get some people to work on it because I've got so many other things. Doing interviews and giving speeches, doing other CEO kind of things.
As a former academic and as somebody who taps into the wonderful universities in this area and others, as you mentioned, I wonder if you could comment a bit about the state of computer science in the academic realm. And I ask this because there are those who lament the fact that the area that SAS, for instance, is strongest, analytics, that that isn't necessarily a discipline that is taught very well at the university level. And I wonder if you agree or disagree with that point.
We have actually taken some steps to help the universities develop programs that teach analytics. We have the most successful one is right here at NC State. They have a master's in advanced analytics. It's essentially a 10-month full-time work job to take this master's program. They learn to analyze large amounts of data. They learn what models are appropriate with different types of data. They learn about forecasting, model building. They learn about optimization. It's a great course. They're graduating 80 students every year, and we have just approved offering quite a few positions to the graduates of the program. So I think NC State has got the very best master's of advanced analytics. We also have sponsored programs at Texas A&M and LSU, plus there's about 15 other universities now that are offering programs similar to this. To be a successful data scientist, as some people refer to it, you don't necessarily have to have a PhD in statistics or a master's degree, but so much of statistics, master's and PhD, is spent in the theory behind why all this stuff works. If you're a practitioner, you don't need to know all the theory behind it. You just need to know what you're supposed to use and what type of problem, and just enough that you can come up with good models. You know whether your model's any good or not because you test it with some test data and verify how well it works or how well it works on the data that you have already. You don't really need to know all the theory. That's the concept of these master's programs, not all the theory, but how to do the data analysis.
So given the number of universities that you've mentioned that you've sponsored, or others probably still who've elected to go in direction, are you generally optimistic about the quality of engineering or computer science degrees from here forward? There are so many who lament our state in the world in terms of producing good engineering and STEM, more broadly, talent.
First of all, the U.S. produces the very best. There's no question about that in the STEM areas. That's why you'll see over half of the students are foreign students that are in these STEM areas here in the U.S. and working on their master's and PhDs. The issue we have in the U.S. is the fact that we don't have enough American students interested. We need to find some way to motivate our kids to get more interested in this stuff. So, well, I think a lot of it goes back to K-12. I think we need to be paying our STEM teachers more, especially the good ones that show good results, improving the growth of each child and the knowledge that they've achieved. And we need to have some national programs that somehow help kids get more interested. I think the President's Council on Education just recently said that we're going to be 1 million STEM graduates short in the decade. So we have to find a way to produce more STEM students. I think we need probably about 10% more of our kids interested in it. We won't be able to absorb any more than that. But right now it's got a little lopsided with too many kids going into the liberal arts, not enough in the STEM. It just needs to be reversed just a little bit.
If one has the pleasure of driving through this really beautiful campus that you have here, one of the first things, at least that I noticed upon doing so this morning, were the number of flags flying with the word analytics on them, and clearly that is for some time been a very big priority of this organization, needless to say. It's now, over the past few years, become perhaps the hottest trend on the minds of CIOs at a minimum, but to a greater extent CMOs, CEOs, in fact, as well. And I wonder, as an organization and as an individual who's been thinking about this since long before this was such a hot topic across industries, what advantages SAS has relative to others who are newer to the game?
Obviously, we've been in the business for a long, long time. You know, SAS started out as mainly analyzing experiments that occurred on the campuses of all the different land-grant universities. Then we were picked up to analyze data from pharmaceutical companies, all the new drug applications they put in almost every one of them in SAS to do the analysis. But sometime in the early 1990s, some of our banking customers began using SAS to build models to forecast customer behavior, to help make decisions about who should be made what offers, who should be given a credit card. And I think American Express was one of those very, very early users of analytical tools to be able to do modeling and forecasting for customers. Now most banks have 1,000 models that are used every day to help make decisions. So we've been in the middle of this stuff since the 1990s. Of course, the data, you hear about big data. The fact is there is more and more data being generated, especially out of automated systems. We're concerned about all the data that's going to start flowing from cars over the next few years. That's a huge amount to capture. All the telephone calls that are start time, end time, phone numbers that are involved, they produce a billion records a day right there. All the point of sale data is just huge as well. And so many, many machines. They've got sensors on them that send up signals. See some of the big GE jet engines, they've got 5,000 sensor readings a second that are coming out of the engines to help understand what's going on. So we're seeing it being built into more and more machines, just sensors that are producing diagnostic information about the status of that machine. So it's just a huge amount of data that many of our companies have. I'd say about 5, maybe 10% at most have this really, really big data that they have to worry about. I think the average big data is 4.2 terabytes. If you've got big data, then that's about the average amount that you have. That's a lot of data.
I wonder, as your business has evolved and as the users of SaaS have changed from some of those early adopters among the pharmaceutical companies and financial services organizations and now to a much broader set of companies, how has the customer within those companies changed? Is the average customer now a chief information officer, a chief marketing officer, some sort of analytics role within the organization? Is there any way to sort of typify that and how that's evolved?
I'd say one of the strongest areas and one that's been using it is most is for what we call customer intelligence, understanding your customer. Again, what marketing campaigns does a person belong in? So we have a lot of usage in that area. So marketing is one of the big areas. I guess our biggest growth area right now is really in fraud detection. All the different states are using us for Medicaid fraud, quite a few. IRS is using us for fraud detection. So we almost probably the number one fraud detection for credit card fraud, where we help make that decision whether or not to accept the charge. We score it based on previous patterns of usage. Is this a complete different thing that they're doing? And those are incredibly complex models that we use for neural network models. They have 600 variables in them, so it's quite complex. So fraud is definitely our biggest growth area right now.
Given the diversity of executives that just among the things you just mentioned, that could be a chief information security officer, it could be a chief risk officer, you mentioned the chief marketing officer as a user of data, and now as data has implications and there's a recognition of the value of it across such a broad set of executives, does it make the sales process more complicated that there's not a specific individual within the company that you can target? Or does it actually make it easier that since there are so many people who are cognizant of the need to use data in a better way?
Well, our products over the years have evolved into many very specific areas. We will talk to the chief risk officer at banks that are involved in computing the value at risk for the bank and all of the CCAR compliance that banks are subjected to now by the Fed. So risk officer there, then you've got a marketing officer here, you've got somebody in charge of IT that's in charge of doing reporting, and we have software that analyzes all the usage of hardware in a data center. So we'll have that's directed towards the IT. So we're not just a single product anymore. We have a multitude of products that are targeted for a different industry and different applications within those industries.
You also built a web of technology partners, sitting a few Teradata, EMC, Greenplum, Oracle, Accenture. As you think about developing an ecosystem of partners to help you do what you do, what's the criteria that you use?
Hardware, software side, we're looking for mainly companies that our customers have asked us to work with. So we're working fairly closely right now with SAP, trying to make sure that we can access all the data in HANA. That's their new in-memory database that they've developed. And we're doing that because our mutual customers ask us to please work together. Some of our very biggest customers that are SAP customers want us to be able to get at the data that's inside of SAP analysis. I think SAP continues to stress ERP systems, payment systems, operational systems, I would say. And we are the world's best at analytics. Our customers want us to work together. Teradata, we again had a number of mutual customers, and Teradata was one of the first companies to have a distributed database. So their database is not just a single file, it's a lot of little files. And they use different processors to read each of the different files to try to answer questions, and those results are all pulled back, merged back together. So it's a much, much faster way of analyzing data. We worked with Teradata, said, look, when we want a stream of data from you, we don't want one stream. We want 100 streams. So each one of those small files that you've got out there, we want you to send that to us directly, not filtered back up through to the head node to send it to us. So we worked with them on that. We also worked with them to embed our models that we developed into their database. So that once a model is computed, we can download that model. And now you can just use your normal SQL query language to actually compute the value for that model for each record. We had other customers that were looking at GreenPlum at the same time. And we were actually working with GreenPlum before they were acquired by EMC. We continue to work closely with EMC on that now.
You've always advocated throwing a lot of profit back into R&D and spending an awful lot in that. And I'm curious actually now where some of that R&D funding is focused. What are some of the things that are particularly exciting for you as you look at your crystal ball a few years out?
The main thing we are doing right now is to continue to evolve our high-performance analytics. We have just about everything we do now, we're doing in massively parallel form. Instead of using a single processor, we'll use hundreds of processors. And by doing so, you have to take every algorithm we've ever written that was thought of in the terms of a single process. You do this thing, and then you do the next thing in sequence, and then you do the next thing in sequence. And you go through everything in that sequence. Now you've got to think about, well, how can I do this if I let 100 different processors work on just part of this problem? So you really, really have to rethink the way we've always thought about how algorithms are developed and done. So we've been very successful at that. Just about everything we've done, we've been able to figure out how to execute it in parallel for high performance speed. And we got started on, I guess it's been 4.5 years ago, when a banker in Singapore said, can you do my risk calculations any faster? They're taking 18 hours. And we studied the process that was going on, or I did anyway, and I said, we can't do that with a single processor any faster. I mean, you know, we might shave 10% of it off. We're not going to make it significantly faster. So I began playing around with some of the algorithms they were using. Discovered, well, yeah, we could actually compute this matrix in parallel. We can process it. When you work with a matrix, it's just one row at a time. So it turns out those rows don't even have to be on the same machine, as long as you know where they are. Communicate back and forth and tell people what to operate on, what row to operate on at this time. So that's what we did. And that process now takes about 12 minutes. That's the kind of exciting things that we're doing to get our performance improved.
Obviously, SAS has a very strong brand that's been built over a long period of time, as you noted. But interestingly enough, over the past several years, when somebody refers to SaaS and technology, oftentimes they're referring to software as a service. And I wonder if you've ever put any thought into the fact, obviously there's no need changing the name, that would probably be much more trouble than would be worth given the strength of the SaaS brand. But is there any sort of thought given to erosion, given the fact that now that when somebody refers to SaaS, oftentimes they're referring to software as a service?
No, we don't plan to change. As a matter of fact, we have software as a service ourselves.
Lastly, I want to ask you, as a former professor, if you were a professor today and one of your students were to ask you for advice on where to focus their attention, kind of like the movie The Graduates, the gentleman that gives advice to Dustin Hoffman's character about what industry to go into or what area of study to go into, are there certain things that are particularly exciting for you today that you would advise the young students of today to focus their attention on?
I would say plastics, yeah. Well, I think analytics, of course, is going to be here for a long, long time. And people need to develop the skill sets to analyze large amounts of data, to know exactly what models to use. My recommendation is sign up at NC State and take the master's program over there in analytics. Every graduate gets 2 or 3 offers, some of them as high as $120,000, $130,000. I think 80 is sort of like the floor. You can go from whatever you're doing now, and in a year's time, you can increase the value of your skill set by 30% or 40% of what you're doing now. And there's a big demand, huge demand. As I say, every graduate of that degree is getting 2 or 3 offers.
Well, Dr. Goodnight, thank you so much for taking time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you and honored to have gotten to know you a little bit.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat is a catalyst in communities of customers, contributors, and partners creating better technology the open source way. Connect to an ecosystem of innovation at redhat.com today to learn more. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.